today.
It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law, the right advice at the right time, and Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben. Good
morning, Ben.
Hope everybody's well and waded into the through the water today.
We are here.
Okay, so what are we talking about today?
Ben, we're going to talk about declaratory judgment actions.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, a mouthful here this morning.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, basically we're going to talk about this right of the court to interpret documents and to enter a final order or judgment as it relates to how a document, you know, is to be followed. For example,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you have a will or you have a trust and maybe it's not drafted so well,
mm-hmm.
and there might be some ambiguity in the document itself about what the grantor or trustor's intent was or the testator's intent was when it was drafted, then, you know, you find yourself sometimes where the trustee or the executor is kind of making guesses mm-hmm. about what was intended here. So
yeah.
they have a fiduciary duty to follow through whatever that document states, with, in many cases, far-reaching ramifications. So if we're not real clear about what the document states, there's a little bit of risk, maybe a lot of risk, for the fiduciary if we don't have a declaration of the court as to how the document is officially interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that's a lot of legalese there in a couple paragraphs. But, you know, dealing with a particular case right now involving this, where a gentleman drafted his own will years ago,
mm-hmm.
and the will seems to be just as clear as it can be, because in the will itself, he named only one beneficiary,
mm-hmm.
his very close friend. Didn't have children, wasn't married, mm-hmm. named his close friend, basically someone he had a relationship with.
Right.
Okay. They had been together for 20 years,
mm-hmm.
or almost 20 years when he died. So seems pretty obvious. But then when you read through from beginning to end in the will, he never comes out and states with clarity and specificity where he wants his real estate to go.
Huh.
He talks about his jewelry. He talks about his cash. He talks about his this, is that, is this, is that, but never comes out and really states anything specific with regard to his real estate. Well, the bulk of his estate was comprised of real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Now he references where the deeds are, and with deeds, you're only going to be dealing with real estate.
Right.
He references any real estate conveyed herein. He talks about real estate. So if you read the four corners of that document, meaning from beginning to end, it certainly appears that that individual's intent was for everything, including the real estate, to pass to this certain very close friend.
Yes, for him to have only one heir, essentially, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's no one else named.
Right.
But in the event you're in a situation like that and the document is not clear as it relates to the intent of the testator, mm-hmm. then whatever is not controlled by the will then passes through intestacy.
Mm-hmm.
So in this particular situation, we have to look to siblings, basically, because there were no children.
Mm-hmm.
Parents are deceased, so we look at the siblings. So ironically, I don't think he had a very close relationship with his siblings.
Mm-hmm.
But the siblings stand to inherit this real property that has significant value unless the court interprets the will otherwise. So that's a classic case of where these issues need to be put before the court and the document needs to be examined. In this particular case, it will be a jury trial.
Mm-hmm.
The jury will be given the instructions from the judge regarding the law applying to these things and what they have to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll make a final determination as to what they believe the intent of the testator was.
Well, let me back up a second. Is it the estate that's seeking the declaratory judgment here? Or is it the siblings?
Well, that's a great question. It is the beneficiary that's named in mm-hmm. the will, who's a close friend.
Right.
Individually and as fiduciary, as mm-hmm. executor
as
of
executor.
The estate.
Yeah, right.
So he's doing it in both
hats,
both capacities.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, a lot to unpack there. Of course, first of all, as Wes mentioned, what if this executor, mm-hmm. who does also happen to be a alleged, if you will, beneficiary of right. the real property, although it's not clear, what if he real property is valuable?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
well. And what if the property is sold and distributed to him, and then lo and behold, the interpretation is that this property was not covered, not included in the terminology of the document, and therefore should pass to the siblings because of the fact that those property that property was not included in the will, and therefore passes according to mm-hmm. not a will law, or known as intestacy, mm-hmm. when we die without a will. You know, what an interesting case.
It is fascinating.
Now, of course, this begs the question about, you know, the clarity of a document and how very important it is that a document not only have clarity, but to get a bit legal here on Let's Talk Legal, Ben, you know, the structure of a document.
Mm-hmm.
All good last wills and testament have what is known as a rest, residue, and remainder clause, mm-hmm. or a remainder clause, which picks up, if you will, traps up anything that's not otherwise mentioned specifically, like jewelry, like cash, like the car, and passes it to the residuary.
Mm-hmm.
And this will did not have, with clarity, that residuary clause. I had a client in my office last week that I really had to kind of really go into kind of a law lesson about this, mm-hmm. because this client was having difficulty understanding that we have to have a residuary clause. He wanted everything so very specifically
mm-hmm.
Outlined, and that's just fine. We can be very specific. But notwithstanding being very specific, we good estate lawyers are going to have a residuary clause.
Right.
Because what if this person goes out at the last minute and the last 2 or 3 years of their life and buys something, mm-hmm. you know, or has something, has an interest in a business, has a different piece of real property, a lot that they just happen to pick up. We always need this residuary clause. So we need a residuary clause, which this document did not have. And secondly, we always need to consider contingencies. And we've talked about this on the program before, that contingent beneficiaries, contingent executors, what if, then this. These are the kinds of things that lawyers talk about. And we get this all the time. Ben, I know that I'm meeting with you, with your mm-hmm. family friend today, and we will be asking, well, what if that person isn't alive? What if that person cannot be your executor? And this is sometimes when Wes and I get kind of the blank stare, if you will, mm-hmm. because that's the kind of thing the client hasn't thought about. But last but not least, got so much here to say about this, is think of the cost involved now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of the fact that this document did not have clarity, now there is this issue between part of the estate going by intestacy to the siblings, the other part of the estate going to this close friend, and here we are. Having to, quote, litigate this, get court clarity on this, get the court to direct by declaratory judgment what the document does or does not mean. I mean, this should be and is a client's worst nightmare.
Yes, absolutely.
Delay, cost, all of those factors.
Yeah. I'm just curious, could in this particular case, could other documents besides the four corners, other documents play into it, like healthcare, power of attorney, just to indicate the overall nature of that relationship?
Probably not. I mean, you're mainly looking at the document. I mean, there's going to be some evidence that's going to come in to identify the relationship, you know, of the parties, mm-hmm. those who are involved, those kind of things. And I think the jury is going to draw certain inferences from that. But, you know, really they're required to look at the four corners of the document and interpret it, you know, based on the way that it's written.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I think another issue that's really important for our listeners to, you know, understand and that we should talk about is that sometimes executors in estates, they think that their they have carte blanche authority to make decisions with regard to whatever they think is right because they are the executor. And we get into that sometimes where let's say that the will is ambiguous with regard to whatever issue it may be, and then the executor, not ones we represent because we don't let them think this way, but, I mean, sometimes they run into an issue where they think, well, I'm just going to take the position that this is what is meant.
Right.
Well,
and they may have been very close to the person, so they may
That may be right, but that's a risky thing to do because, you know, in the event we're talking about something that has significant value or some type of decision that's very important, then that executor could find themselves in a position where the court has determines later that they breached their fiduciary duty. They're personally liable as a result of that. And this declaratory judgment action that we've talked about basically is their free pass that tells them this is the way you have to do it.
Okay, well, more to come in just a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Your questions are welcome at 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674. Hey, welcome back. 7:46 in the morning here on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. We're talking about some of the hiccups that can happen in a state case.
Wes has another example, which we want him to share here in a moment. But just to continue to focus this a bit, the court will help us, Ben. That's kind of the focus of the program today. It's called a declaratory judgment, and yes, that's a mighty big word. But the court will help us with the interpretation. We don't want to have to go there. But if we do in these cases, which happen occasionally, then it is good to know that a judge and or jury will help us interpret this ambiguity and give the fiduciary, the executor, or the trustee the direction that they need for their own protection. Because as we've discussed on the program before, otherwise they can be held personally liable as the fiduciary. So these executors or trustees find their way to a good law firm, and they want some protection. They want to be know that if I interpret it this way, I will not later be held responsible, and therefore the relief system that we apply for is this declaratory judgment action.
Once you have an order in the file, you know, signed by either the clerk of court or the superior court judge indicating this is the way the will is interpreted, depending on what the circumstances are as far as who would sign that, where the jurisdiction lies, then it doesn't really matter what, you know, the interpretation would be by someone else. I mean, you're free to proceed consistent, you know, with that judgment, and no one can come back later unless you acted contrary to, you know, that direction in the judgment or the order. So
some of those are under the jurisdiction of the clerk, and some need to go to Superior Court?
Yeah, I mean, the clerk really has original jurisdiction, but if it becomes a contested issue, you can ask for a jury, and that's going to go before the Superior Court. So, yeah, that's... If it's a simple issue and it's something that we just can't get a family settlement agreement on, but it's, you know, maybe not that consequential with regard to the assets themselves, maybe the best thing to do is to file, you know, a petition for declaratory relief before the clerk and just have it heard before the clerk, because you can get the hearing much more quickly. And if it's not contested, you know, why go through the process of, you know, teeing it up in Superior Court? So, you know, another case that I have is similar to this is a case where a gentleman passed away. He had a business, and he left all the stock in the business to his co-worker, basically, who owned a smaller interest in the business, a young man who had basically stepped into the role of carrying on this business. The thing that's interesting about that is the business was basically a grading-type business that did – land moving and that type thing. So it had, had equipment and
had those
type things. And, unfortunately there were two items of equipment that were not titled in the name of this corporation. So what he had done in his will is he left all of the stock in the corporation to this individual.
But not
these two items that are valuable items were not named in the titled in the name of the corporation. So the court may need to then have a declaratory judgment action to make a declaration as to whether they were corporate assets or not. Now we get into an issue of who paid for them, so on and so forth. Well, the facts in this particular case are that the records of the corporation indicate that the corporation, in fact, did pay for all of those.
Right.
So it certainly appears that those were, in some manner, at least in an equitable manner, corporate assets and should pass consistent with the terms of what was intended by the testator because mm-hmm. those assets were paid for by the corporation. So that's another example of that gets outside of the scope of document interpretation, mm-hmm. but still something that, you know, would be consistent with what we see as far as questions in estate administration.
I would imagine if the corporation had taken depreciation off of those assets.
Tax returns are pretty important.
Yeah.
No question about that. You know, who paid for them? That's no question about that. Was there a loan, mm-hmm. you know, on these assets? And what are the records showing with regard to who was paying that loan? I think things with regard to the assets themselves and where they were maintained, you know, who paid the taxes on them, all these type of things. So, there's a lot of financial fact-finding with regard to those type issues.
Ben, you began to see in our discussion this morning where we're kind of at the end game with these factual scenarios, and you can imagine that Wes and I are very aware of these end games that we get involved in, mm-hmm. which lead us back to the importance of the questions on the planning side. Mm-hmm. How many times have we mentioned on this program that when we are putting together our planning documents, we have to look at how assets are titled.
Mm-hmm.
We have to look at, is there inconsistency between the way in which the asset happens to be titled and what we're doing in the documents? I mean, are our beneficiaries on our retirement accounts, our PODs at
right.
the banks and CDs, are these inconsistent with our document? Mm-hmm. This gentleman very clearly said he wanted his stock in the company to go to this young partner who is taking over the business.
Mm-hmm.
But then, unfortunately, we've got some major pieces of equipment that are titled in the name of the decedent individually.
Mm.
They're not titled in the name of the business. So they did not with clarity pass to this younger partner of his business. They're now in the residuary, and they pass to other beneficiaries. And so here we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is very important during the planning stage that these questions get asked. This gentleman had a good document. It's just that then there was not the follow through on the follow-up, if you will, to make sure that the assets were titled consistent with what the intentions are in the document. And, Ben, I cannot mention how many times we see this issue.
Mm.
This is a very common issue, and we try to do our very best at bringing this to the forefront on the planning stage so that these kinds of, quote, accidents don't happen.
Okay.
You know, another case that comes to mind, this is a good example of a case that does not fit in the declaratory judgment action type mm-hmm. scenario. Lady passes away, mother has four children,
mm-hmm.
and she ends up leaving all of her assets, which include a paid for home and over $1 million, to one child.
Mm.
The majority of those cash assets pass through beneficiary designation through an annuity and also through a joint account with this one daughter.
Hmm.
And the other three children who had a very close relationship with their mother say that the only reason that one daughter was on this joint account, it was for access so that she could write the bills.
Right, right.
Yeah, write
typical
the checks for the bills.
Thing
yep.
that happens, yeah.
And the only reason that this one child was on the annuity is because she's the one who set up the annuity, this one child. So that takes us into an issue of potential undue influence and maybe lack of capacity, depending on how old the mother was and what condition she was in at the time that these things were signed. That takes us to a completely different area.
We'll go back a few shows to that one on
responsibility, we've definitely talked about that one over the years.
Okay. More to come in a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Hey, welcome back here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, and the twists and turns of estate practice. That's what we follow all the time here, right?
No question about that. And, you know, whenever we go off the air, it seems like we just keep talking about different cases. And, you know, of course, we don't use any names, obviously, and, and, change the identity of those involved. It's like one of those TV shows, right?
And these cases are not, you know, unique. I mean, you know, these cases are fairly common factual scenarios.
Yeah, when you have beneficiaries.
I mean, there are many cases in our office through the years where assets, equipment, trucks, vehicles, whatever, property, land, Ben, that was used, the office building, if you will, for the company, with the company passing to a particular person and everything involved in the company, and yet the title to the land of the building of the company was not in the name of the business. You know, that went, you know, left hand and right hand, not coordinated. So, no, we're not referring to any specific cases. I mean, these are fairly common dilemma actions. We see lots of files where, unfortunately, there's not a remainder clause in a will or in a trust, and there has to be interpretation. We've had several of those in our office through the years.
And again, these are things that, as we come back to almost always at this time of the program, is come back to planning.
And Just get the $100, $150 will done. Have someone sit down and go through it with you and make sure that there's not a mistake there. You know, I mean, I guess for some folks, it's just a lack of convenience. They feel as though they can go online and just print it off and get it done. But, you know, this poor guy who certainly intended to leave everything to his close friend, the person we talked about at the beginning of the program, he's dead and gone. I mean, This is a done deal now, and we have to live with the document that he had when he passed away.
Right.
And it's creating not only difficulty and expense, but it's really drawing a further wedge between this friend and his family.
Right. We'll have more to come next week on Let's Talk Legal. If you want to find out more about solving your own legal issues, too, you want to call on the folks at Harvell & Collins, harvellandcollins.com. Call for that appointment at 726-9050, 1107 Bridges Street in Moorhead City.